Hey, y'all. You know what December is. I mean, it is the holiday season, but it's also when Feminist Frequency has our annual end of year campaign, which allows you all to help us keep making all of this great work that we're doing. From the Games and Online Harassment Hotline that provides emotional support for people who make and play games, to a training that we're building with Take This for the games industry to help end abuse and toxicity in workplaces and empower workplaces to be better and safer for all of their employees, to all of the podcasts that we are working on. And hey, little side note, we are working on a new one that I'm really excited about. So if you want to help us keep making all of this work, doing all of this work, helping all of the people that we support through all of our programming, please consider kicking in a few bucks to our end of year campaign. You can visit givebutter.com/femfreak2021. That's givebutter.com/femfreak2021.
The fact that, as you say, like, there's, you know, here a tit, there a tit, everywhere a tit tit in this film.
Welcome to Feminist Frequency Radio. This is the show that asks you to be critical of the media you love. I'm Anita Sarkeesian, and I've spent the last couple of weeks negotiating a dowry for Ebony Adams. But you know what? Her dad's not paying up.
He absolutely wouldn't. He would be like, listen, you take her or you don't. But
on today's episode, we have got two wonderful things in store, a surprise guest, and a discussion about Paul Verhoeven's absolutely bonkers new movie, Benedetta. Stay tuned.
A choisi notre bienheureuse sœur, Benedetta.
Santa Benedetta.
Benedetta.
Hey, Ebony.
Hey, Anita.
Do you know why I'm so excited?
Is it the same reason I'm so excited?
Yes.
I bet it is.
We have a very special guest to round out this season of Feminist Frequency Radio, Carolyn Pettit.
What?
What?
She's here?
Yes!
Wow, I've always wanted to meet her. Yes.
We have missed you so much, Carolyn.
We really have.
Well, I've missed podcasting with y'all, too. And
girls, quit lying. I know you wake up every week and you're like, another week not recording the podcast.
Well, it's a little tough to fit into my busy schedule on the regular. That's true. I do work
Carolyn's busy schedule.
I'm taking meetings, going to New York Fashion Week. Going to expensive restaurants.
Movie
premieres.
Oh, I wish. Although I did go to the North American premiere of this film that we're talking about today, and I'll share a little bit of what that was like when we get to the movie discussion.
But, okay, how's your life, Carol?
Yeah, it's good. I'm in New York City now. You know, I have a new job. I'm managing editor at a website called Kotaku. You know, we cover video games, as most of our listeners probably know. I'm really proud of the work that we do covering things like the current labor and workplace issues that, you know, I guess particularly maybe at Activision Blizzard, but, you know, throughout the industry. I think we do really good work covering that, and you know, but also just I think we do really interesting criticism. I think we talk about games and games culture in interesting ways, and I'm thrilled to be a part of it. So I'm also thrilled to be here in a new city. I mean, I love the Bay Area, but I'd been there for a long time, and it was a good opportunity for me to shake things up in my life a bit. And
really important question.
Yes.
How are you dealing with the weather?
Oh, it's not so bad. I mean, not yet anyway. Knock on wood. I mean, I've definitely had to buy some warmer jackets and scarves and caps and gloves and things. But so far, it's at least I may get tired of it eventually, but right now, you know, I mean, it's kind of invigorating to have to experience seasons in a way that you don't in the Bay Area. I mean, I saw snow recently, and it was pretty exciting because I hadn't seen snow in such a long time. So, you know, I'm trying to enjoy that aspect, and thus far, I kind of am enjoying that aspect of it, of being here.
Amazing. Wow.
Yeah.
Well, my joy for your new life outweighs my missing you on the podcast.
Mine doesn't come back.
Thank you.
I know. You know, they say to write positive affirmations or whatever, like lie to yourself until it's true. That's what I was just trying to do. Okay, hold on. We're going to pause. Hold on. Carolyn, are you recording on a separate audio than what we're hearing?
I'm recording on my Zoom audio.
Yeah. Okay, great. Just because there's, I'm hearing some mic ruffling. So as long as that's not on the audio recording, it's fine.
Oh, right. Yeah, that mic. Sorry, but that's just what my headphones probably
It's not annoying enough for us. For the podcast, I wanted to just make sure that wasn't the podcast audio.
Of course.
Okay, dope. Ebony, were you going to say something?
Whatever it was, it doesn't matter. Let's get into Benedetta.
Yeah, let's do it. Caro, do you want to tell us your experience before we like do our little boring intro of the movie?
No, I don't know. Let's set up the movie first, and then I will talk about it.
All right, Ebony, why don't you tell us a little bit about what we're about to talk about?
There's no way I can adequately prepare listeners who have not viewed this movie. I will say I spent 3/4 of the movie going, did Uma Thurman and Jodie Comer have a baby? Because Benedetta looks just like both of them. Anyway, here at Feminist Frequency Radio, we will never knowingly pass up an opportunity to see Charlotte Rampling in a wimple. We make that vow to you. That is why we chose to mortify our flesh with the latest offering from director and co-writer Paul Verhoeven. Also, when we asked Carolyn to come back and be a guest on the pod, we knew we had to make it worth her cinematic while. So, Caro, I know you were like, listen, don't give me the easy stuff. Bring me the hard stuff. I want to get into it. I want to, you know, flex my muscles here. You don't have Thomas Keller swing by and give an opinion on canned soup. You don't ask Vera Wang to sew a button on your ratty old cardigan. And you don't ask Caro to come back and talk about anything but a very Caro movie.
Okay.
Long searching looks.
This is not a very Caro movie. I'm sorry. Just to be clear.
We're going to get into that. So Benedetta is the story of a fervently devoted 17th century Italian nun was consumed by the force of her transcendent visions and the illicit attraction she shares with another woman in the convent. The vibrancy of Sister Benedetta's inner life is matched by the insistent reality of the world and the body. The film offers a buffet of bodily sights, sounds, and smells that exude from the screen. It is both shockingly carnal and seductively beatific, and it owes as much to films like The Seventh Seal as it does to Suspiria. Let's get into it. I just watched this. So it is a very
like,
fresh.
Like right well, now before
it
we
is,
recorded.
It is right out of the ebony oven. It's hot and ready. But I know, Carol, you watched it like a couple of months ago, right?
Yeah.
Because you're fancy and glamorous now. You went to the premiere?
So I'm glad that it's so vivid in your memory because unfortunately it has faded a bit in mine. So what I went to was not like a gala premiere. There were no celebrities there. It was shown at the New York Film Festival, which happened to be taking place basically like not long after I arrived in New York. And somebody just happened to invite me, you know, they had tickets and they were like, we have an extra one. Somebody dropped out of our group. Do you want to come? And I said, sure. And so, and you know, I'm very interested in Paul Verhoeven's films. I mean, I think he's certainly a very interesting and vital filmmaker. And, yes, of course, I was not going to pass up the opportunity. But what was fascinating about that experience of going to see the film there was that there were a small but very, you know, vocal and attention-getting group of Catholic protesters outside of the film. And so they had signs like, and I took it, I'm looking at my own tweets from that day to remind myself. So for instance, they had this banner that read, "We vehemently protest the blasphemous lesbian movie Benedetta that insults the sanctity of Catholic nuns.
And well, I mean, I had the same sign when I went to go see Dune. I vehemently protest this film about lesbian space nuns. So I get it.
So, I mean, I, you know, it's like, I did not love this film. I will, you know, I'll just say that, like, we can get into it more. However, you know, the fact that, just the fact almost that provoked this group, you know, to come out and protest, did sway my sympathies more in its favor, because I want to piss off these people too, and because I think the things that I object to in it are different from the things that they object to in it. Like, I think what they object to in it is just like, well, it's the sexuality. It's. I mean, it's obviously it's the homosexuality specifically, the queerness, but it's just even the portrayal of people of faith, you know, people in, you know, nuns or clergy, being like full-blooded, like sexual, like complex human beings who experience lust and, you know, desire and all of these things. And it's like, you know, there's obviously in cinema, I mean, to me, there's nothing that, you know, humanizes, that makes faith more interesting, that more illuminating than being honest about the fact that people of faith also, you know, experience desire and pleasure and, you know, all of these things. I mean, like, so
I mean, what they should be mad about is not the queerness. They should be mad about the fact that, like, this whole movie is just a condemnation of the hypocrisy of the religion, you know?
Well,
yeah, I mean,
sure.
I think like that's right? That's like, the film, I think, tries to walk a line, and to my mind is fairly successful in suggesting that there is a difference between sort of sincere spiritual yearning versus the very worldly desires of the church, you know, like the institution of the church. And so you have like that great scene with when we first meet the nuncio, played by Merovingian Lambert Wilson, you know, yes, in that fantastic purple robe, right? And this just like voluptuary of a servant who comes in to serve him and, you know, flashes her boob at the scandalized former abbess, right? So I think like the film has very little patience for the manipulations and the machinations of the church. At no point do we feel as if the words coming out of the men in power are sincere, are driven by anything other than their desire to advance further, to achieve what they want to achieve as men in the world. And they will use anything that it takes, whether it's, you know, the visions of Benedetta, whether it is, you know, the labor of these community of nuns, you know, like anything and everything will be put to use. So yeah, I think the film is very clear that, you know, like the church is it's full of shit. It's full of shit.
Absolutely. And I do love that about it. And also, so yes, you know, to Anita's point, this is not a very Caro movie. And I would say it's not a very Caro movie for one reason why is that it is amped up to 11. It is a, you know, Verhoeven. It is.
Also, it took place on more than one day.
shut up. It's a film. I find it a film of great, like, appetite, sensual. Like, you feel Verhoeven's sensual and sexual appetites on every level through the film. And no, I'm serious here. I mean,
I know you are.
And you know, I can enjoy that to a point, but but the films that I really gravitate to do tend to be a little more, like, have more of a low-key kind of rhythm to them.
So you're telling me
they don't involve... Sorry, go ahead.
But just if someone had said this was a film directed by Paul Greenaway, you wouldn't have been surprised. Is that what you're telling me, Carol?
I haven't seen enough Greenaway to speak to that, I'm sorry to say. But,
oh,
you know,
God, like, rival film nerds. Here we go.
But, you know, I think that, like, the sex scenes in this film, I think, are fascinating. Were fascinating to me because of how much the ecstasy of them did mm-hmm. seem both kind of, you know, physical, carnal, and in a sense, kind of spiritual, right? Mm-hmm. I think there is a spiritual quality to them. And yet, like, although what I guess one thing that I find really interesting and complicated about this film is that although Benedetta is positioned as like this force that could undo, you know, the church's power to some degree, I found her very evil in her own way. Like, I think, you know, I'm watching Succession right now, right? And like, that's a show in which, like, everyone is just terrible. Everyone's awful, in my opinion. I, you know, although I think Benedetta in this film is she's not somebody, like, I sort of root for her because I want her to undermine the abusive, you know, oppressive use of authority and power as the church wields it. But I think that she gets very drunk on her own power as well. And like you can see when she's able to, like, deliver a comeuppance to somebody who has done her wrong, like how just she just seems to kind of revel in it in this way that is, like, I found kind of ghastly too. Yeah. So, you know, I think it's interesting that the film does not, at least for me, she's using what power she finds through manipulation and mm-hmm. deceit and maybe even her own delusion. Like, maybe she believes that, you know, Jesus, like, all her amazing, spectacular visions of Jesus as action hero, right? I mean, like, but it's still a delusion. I mean, as far as I'm concerned.
Okay, so I want to come back to this, but yeah. I need to come in with my heavy-handed, absurd analysis of things, which is, I think it's probably safe to assume that Verhoeven has had sex in his life and, you know, married, mm-hmm. whatever.
If there's anything I didn't want to contemplate.
But the reason I say this is because I would describe this movie as a 12-year-old boy who yes. has never had sex before and, like, is living out all of their titty fantasies mm-hmm. in one big go. Like, some people are arguing that this is, like, nunsploitation, which is, you know, fair, I guess. But to me, it was like this weird mixing of, like, trying to see things from, like, a female, like, sexuality perspective, but was so aggressively male gaze that I was like, oh, yeah. my God. Like, every single moment that you could see a tit, any right. single moment that, like, you wouldn't be expecting to see a boob, one just fucking pops out. Like, you know, and, like, one, there's a scene where there's a woman who's, like, who's pregnant and she just, like, squirts her fucking milk out of her boob for no reason. What? There's another scene where another woman's, like, boob is, like, it's rotted. And so it's an excuse so that we can see Benedetta. Holy shit.
Wow.
Benedetta.
Wow.
Benedetta looking at her boob. Like, there's another scene where she's like, I had a vision where Jesus replaced my heart with a bigger heart and it's too big. Touch my boob.
Yes.
Like, mm-hmm. Oh, my God.
Like, I think that the woman who squirts milk from her breast, that's partially illustrating, again, the kind of hypocrisy of the church, because that's the, you know, that's
yes,
the
totally.
Lustful, but you know, I
walked out of the movie going, so I walked out of the movie with two things. One was it was sensationalist with no real value to the sensationalism to some degree. Like, I think that it could have been more intentional in how it did it instead of just being like, boobs, 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 let's all look at boobs. But the other thing is I did actually walk out of the movie going, why was this made? What was the point? Which I was disappointed by, because I do think that despite, like, you know, Verhoeven's not my favorite director by any means, but I think that he has a perspective and I think that he has something to say and it's clear what he's saying. And in this, I was like, I guess you're saying the church is hypocritical? Like, it felt so meandery and, like, And just kind of like, why did you make this? And that's a really weird feeling to walk out of a movie with.
I enjoyed the movie. And that's because when I surrender to Paul Verhoeven's insistent lack of subtlety, I have a great time. You know, I really do have a great time. And I think, you know, so there are the themes, you know, that Verhoeven is playing with, and the various techniques that he uses to try and express something in the film. But I mean, they're like, if you take all of that away, I do think the film is luscious to look at. I mean, the way that the cinematographer like plays with light and colors is so deliberate in this film. I mean, like, I'm thinking about the scene where she's an adult now, and I think her parents have come back to the convent for something. I can't remember what. But anyways, there's a feast, right? And there's this shot of grapes on the table, and just like the vivid purple of those grapes, or, you know, the crimson of blood sometimes. Like, I just thought it was an exquisite movie to look at in a lot of ways. And I did laugh at the way that Verhoeven, you know, sort of, he refuses to allow you to not recognize the body in this, you know? And I mean, you can call it like heavy-handed, which it absolutely is. But I think, you know, in another director's hands, this film would have been so much in the mind. It would have been this very sort of like contemplative, sort of, you know, like psychic exploration of faith and power and desire. But Paul Verhoeven is like, no. This is a human story, and I'm situating it in the body and like bodily appetites. Well,
that's,
you know,
really convenient. So it's convenient that it's being done in these very particular bodies.
Sure. Oh, absolutely, you know? Absolutely. And I mean, like, the fact that, as you say, like, there's, you know, here a tit, there a tit, everywhere a tit tit in this film. Like, absolutely. And it's of course, like, the metaphor of, like, you know, breasts being the signifier of motherhood and, you know, the feminine and the divine feminine. Yes, absolutely. He paints with a very, very, like, dark, deep, broad brush with that. But as I said, like, when I just sort of recognized that everything was going to be underlined, it was, you know, it was like an illuminated script of its own, you know, there's going to be bold print. I was like, yeah, I'm in for the ride of this sexy nun movie. And by the way, the thing that did bother me the most is the fact that Bartolomeo, who is like Benedetta's sort of like teacher in the sensual arts, right? I have a real problem with the fact that Bartolomeo is the person who introduces her to this and is in her way like the primary driver of that, at least initially, knowing her history, knowing that she has been sexually assaulted and abused so horrifically by her father and her brothers, and, you know, abused by like the society at large, right? As a woman in poverty in this period. And so to have her be like that sort of sexual driver and initiate Benedetta into those sensual delights, I had a real problem with.
Well, also remember, like, she assaulted Benedetta several times, and it was like not called out that it was assault, right? Like, I don't think we are supposed to think the word assault in those situations. It feels a lot like the no, 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 yes kind of deal, where it's like, mm-hmm. I'm just going to keep trying until she says yes. And now she's saying yes. So it was okay that I did these things, because right. She really actually wanted it, which is usually done in like by men, like a hetero sort of situation. And here, you know, it's a man's vision bringing this to life. So there's a lot of that in here. But I don't think, like, I'm not like, oh, how dare you do that? I think, hey, harm begets harm. So there's an interesting thing here about the fact that she was assaulted and that's mm-hmm. how she shows affection.
Right.
But that was completely not on the table in terms of the discussion. And mm-hmm. I think this is also related to what I wanted to circle back to, what Carolyn was saying, is how Benedetta is a villain in this in a lot of ways. And I mm-hmm. was really frustrated that the lesbians were the villains, right? Mm-hmm. In this particular story, right?
I mean, I think the church is the biggest villain by far.
I don't think so.
Oh,
yes, but also you have the the mama.
The Reverend Mother?
Yeah, the Reverend Mother. And like her daughter, who are the ones who are like, no, we are actually true believers. She's fucking lying. So it's not like, I don't know, like there's still some goodness. The church could still be good if you didn't have all of these corrupted people. But it, like, that's kind of what I got out of it is like, there's all these people in power who are creating corruption and Benedetta who are corrupt. And Benedetta is trying to get a hold of that. Now, I just think it's a problem when the two lesbians, the two queer people in the movie are the bad ones. Like, you don't really have sympathy for Benedetta at some point. And Bartolomea ends up being like, ultimately, her character didn't mean anything because she just gets like brushed aside and is kind of useless, right? Like, she is just a prop for Benedetta to like get her rocks off.
I mean, I don't know. It's tough with a film like this because I do think that the sensory experience of it all is to some degree kind of the, you know, becomes kind of the point, or like, like it's more about feeling the intensity of life. And I think this is a film in which, you know, to Ebony's point, like the aesthetics and just the of everything matter. And I think what Verhoeven is trying to do at times, just aesthetically and thematically, and just with the intensity of the whole film is kind of contrast like beauty and rot, right, with the plague and everything, and kind of communicate how, but this is all part of life. Like, there, you know, you cannot completely separate the one from the other. Like, there, it's all intertwined, and it's all so much, you know, more intense and immediate and beautiful and ugly than the church can even.
I mean,
like,
I clearly don't have a subtle enough analysis.
I also want to say, like, see, I mean, I'm wary of making those kind. You know, I've become increasingly wary of making the kinds of criticisms of like, where saying that something just feels very like male, you know, in its its perspective, because I sometimes, you know, I will see tweets that say, well, that's like a really kind of essentialist criticism. Like for instance, there was recently, and not to start a whole separate discussion, but like the film The Last Duel, which I haven't seen, right? Mm-hmm. But there were some discourse around The Last Duel that was like, well, it's like Ridley Scott just doing such and such, you know, in this very like male-oriented way. And then there were these female critics, like, you know, like established female critics with a deep history and knowledge and love of film, who were kind of like, fuck you, I love that movie, and I think what you're saying about it is completely like dismissive of, you know, my experience of it. So
would you feel differently if I articulated it more as like a patriarchal perspective?
Well, no,
that creates it more systemically.
Well, what I'm leading up to saying though, first of all, is that I, you know, as reluctant as I am to say it, like, yeah, so the co-writer of this film, right, did speak a little bit before the screening that I was at. And you know, so that colored my perspective of the film a little bit. And I did kind of feel like, oh, this is just like two dudes perving out a little bit. Like, they're just, you know, and so I did. So I, like, I'm sort of saying that I mean, I agree with you at the same time. Like, I do feel like this is very like it. There is a juvenile quality to it that I think is, yes, let's say patriarchal in its outlook.
Which here's the thing is in RoboCop or Starship Troopers, the juvenileness is what gives the. I wouldn't have even called it juvenile, but if I'm like kind of trying to draw a comparison, is like what gives it that kind of weird edge that I think is so distinctive and interesting.
Sure.
The problem is when you attach it to sexuality, that opens up a whole new perspective for me that I think is more damaging and more harmful in this context, right?
Like, you and I, you know, disagree on readings of Starship Troopers because it's the one Verhoeven film where I'm just like, you have failed so radically to achieve what you set out to achieve. And I recognize that Mary Robinette Kowal, you and I, you know the real, right? But I think I totally get what you are saying about the the sort of soft focus,
yeah,
languid, you know, ethereally beautiful, you know, skinny white women, you know, touching each other, and whatever, kind of like sexy times of this film seems very like, you know, Cinemax kind of, you know,
Skinemax.
Exactly. You know, like I totally get it. But because to me, so much of the life of the women in the convent mirrored this kind of, this fascination with the way that all female environments can horrify and bewitch men. Like in, you know, I mentioned Suspiria in the introduction, but just this kind of like 70s horror kind of way, it worked for me because the whole thing was so hyperbolic in its way. You know,
none of it was in
the realm of the real. And so the fact that those sex scenes, you know, seemed ludicrous in their way did not affect me. But I totally get what you're saying, Anita, that it was like, oh, Jesus, this is like a 14-year-old getting like, you know, just perving out.
I mean, it, there's a way in which it reminds me a little bit of Francis Ford Coppola's Dracula film in terms of its like over the top, just energy and sensuality and. Mm-hmm. You know, that's a film. So in that film, like you have Anthony Hopkins as Van Helsing, right? And he is—he himself is a character of such appetite for life, such lustful. Like, and I'm lustful. I don't mean just sexually. I mean just like he has a lust for life in every sense. He loves wine and food, and he just, you know, he is like the embodiment of life, I guess, contrasted with like Dracula's sort of being this embodiment of death and rot and what have you. And there's just this over the top, again, quality and energy to that whole film. And that becomes the energy itself becomes like the point and the almost the experience of watching it as you get carried away. And while I certainly think Dracula is a superior film and a film that was maligned and misunderstood and underrated at the time of its release. I mean, I feel like anyway, that was just an association that I had here where that energy and that there's just, I mean, as much as like, I came out of this film a little like exhausted and a little like, okay, Verhoeven, like take it down a notch. Like, I also like, I mean, I'm also like glad, you know, I am glad that this film exists and that he is a filmmaker who does just go for it. And
I could live without this film existing in the world.
Sure. Understood.
Mm. One thing I was thinking about in the end is like, so you see her visions of Jesus and then you stop.
Action hero Jesus.
Yeah.
Yes.
The action hero's Jesus.
Yeah.
And then as soon as she does the, what's it called again? The hand, the
stigmata.
Yeah.
And as soon as you see the one where like there's a question about the fact that whether she carves her forehead or not, right? If she like is fulfilling the prophecy or, you know, whatever the vision, whatever the church needs to validate the fact that she really is like the second coming of Jesus or whatever. Then you stop seeing visions. You stop seeing her visions. She talks about them, but you don't see them anymore.
Right.
And so it brings up this question of like, is she lying? Is she making this up? And I liked that, like that, you know, you're like, she is obviously, but also maybe not. Like maybe she believes it. Like you still, there's still a little bit of questioning here as the audience about what is happening. So I was a little disappointed at the end when they really drove that home, right? When they really drove home that like she is doing this to herself and she is manipulating. And I sort of wish this is, you know, it's not a big criticism, but I sort of wish they had just like left that, you know, Inception moment where you're like, well, I don't know. It could be, maybe.
Well, I mean, I think, you know, I think Charlotte Rampling's abbess, Sister Felicita, you know, I think she's the one who says, okay, well, you know, if she cut herself, or maybe it was the priest, she cut herself, who are we to say that God didn't lead her to do that, to demonstrate to us, right? I mean, I think that...
But I think seeing the shard of pottery, like, I read that as, like, I hear what you're saying, mm-hmm. but I think that seeing the shard of pottery, like, really leans you into the, like, she is actually being manipulative. Because mm-hmm. you see, like, there's so many things that happen at the end. You see the little bug on the dude, sorry, I'm so sorry, the nuncio. Mm-hmm. And then you see her say, like, oh, you're going to, like, the Jesus voice pops out of her and say, you're going to die. But it's like, well, obviously you're saying that because you know that he has the plague, right? Like, she starts saying all of these things that she can force, right? She can say the plague's not going to come here because she told them to lock up the door, you know, et cetera, et cetera. So you start to see that she is manipulating and making things up and holding, maintaining her power through these really, like, smart ways, right? She's being very
intelligent. Yeah, but I guess, like, I think, like, she's... I am absolutely being generous with my reading in giving her the benefit of the doubt, and that I think Benedetta, and I haven't read the book, but I am absolutely going to, because this film is based on a book, I don't know how loosely, called Immodest Acts, The Life of a Lesbian Nun in Renaissance Italy. And I'm like, put it in my veins. So I will be checking out that book. But it seems to me that Benedetta is so convinced that she is, that God is speaking through her, that she is God's chosen vessel, that the things that she does are thereby rationalized. So it's not as if she is doing these things purely out of malice, or, you know, she truly believes that she has been like called to do these things. So any way in which she affects what God, she wants to do, she believes that's what God wants her to do, right? So I don't think it's as simple as her being like, I want to be the abbess because the abbess has got a bigger room, right? Wait. She certainly, you know, enjoys the freedom and the space and the power that it's offered her. But in her mind, God has chosen her. And so anything she does is then
I guess, which is interesting too, because that is playing into this idea of, like, you see her as a child, she's like, she's so bought in, she's mm-hmm. so bought into the faith that, like, though, you know, I read it as the point being that she, like, you can delude yourself, right? Like, right. that you're so bought into this that, like, how can you believe someone at that point with mm-hmm. that level of faith in something? At the same time, I mean, I guess what you're saying is that, like, so now, even though it's against the church to be a lesbian or to have sex at all, that, like, it's okay because she's doing it because she's a chosen one.
Yeah, she says that scene with Bartolomeo, and she says, you know, there's no shame under God's love. And I can see Benedetta rationalizing it to herself as in, like, the ecstasy that I am feeling, that I am being led to in these moments of connection brings me closer to God, thereby mm-hmm. it is holy. You
Speaking
know?
Of ecstasy, and good for her, mm-hmm. one is, how the fuck does nobody in that convent hear her? She's so Listen. Fucking loud.
And oh my gosh.
And two, that dildo was the best thing I've ever seen. There's a shot of, like, when Bartolomea is actually fucking her, there's a shot where you see Mary's head between her legs going in and out. And I was like, okay, I know you're a creep and a perv, like, directing this, but that shot was so fucking good.
when the abbess is explaining in the court, the trial,
oh my
exactly
God.
What yeah, she saw, yeah. and the, like, court stenographer is taking notes, the look on his face when she explained, holy shit.
You know, so
funny.
There are some moments in this movie that are legitimately funny, mm-hmm. And I was in a movie theater where no one but me and my friend laughed, and we were surrounded by what I assume are men. And it was like, it got really uncomfortable because we're like, wait, you're not really? Laughing. Like, this is fun. Yeah. Wait, do you think this is serious?
It was, you were really harsh in their vibe, Anita. They went in there to see some lesbian titty.
Absolutely was.
Oh my goodness. My goodness. My goodness.
Yeah. All right. What else? What else we got?
There's stuff that I want to talk about in the bonus.
Okay, let's do that then. Okay, so I don't know. I didn't like the movie. I thought it was exploitative in a way that felt really gross. But
periodically,
it sounds like Carolyn and Ebony both, like, were a little bit softer on it than I was to some degree.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, I think it's something that, you know, I wouldn't go to the theater to see it, but
I was available
on Amazon
that.
Prime. Check it out.
I was just thinking that, Ebony. I was like, you watched it at home on a screener, and sure I did. Dragged my ass to a fucking movie theater when I had no time to watch it. And mm-hmm. I wonder if mm-hmm. that just like made me.
I know, I know, and I understand because I dragged my feet getting a screener to you, but and I feel bad about it. But as I was watching this on my couch today, I was like, girl, you made the right decision.
Yeah, you did.
Yeah, I guess just my final thought, you know, here is again just to call back to something I said earlier, which is that, you know, I remember the extreme like condemnation around Martin Scorsese's The Last Temptation of Christ when that film mm-hmm. came out, right? Because it was a film that humanized Jesus in a very specific way and by suggesting that he might experience, you know, sexual desire and temptation, right? Mm-hmm. And I just, again, like, while I don't think, you know, again, I don't love this film, but I really think that when it comes to, you know, to matters of faith and like exploring, I mean, where humanity and faith and like spirituality intersect, to me, they're like, I'm just so in favor of film as a general principle, like giving us portrayals of people who, you know, actually have to struggle with things that they feel or who feel things that they're quote unquote not supposed to, or like, mm-hmm. like all human beings do. I mean, I don't know what could make faith more like sort of approachable and immediate and real and human than that. So, you know, yeah. in that sense, again, I appreciate that this film is part of what I would of that tradition of films that piss off certain, you know, sure. religious mm-hmm. people by venturing into that territory.
Yeah, I mean, I want to make it clear. I am a believer, you know, and I felt no problems with this movie, you know. So at the same time,
can you speak for all Christians when you say
absolutely, absolutely? I can speak for all Christians who like to see a little boob every now and then, you know. No, I just, you know, want to say that, like, to Caro's point, that yes, I loved that, you know, the sort of I love to see people wrestling with these larger right. questions and sometimes making horrific left-hand turns when they should go right, you know, but that is, you know, at its core, what it means to be human and to try and navigate mm-hmm. like the metaphysical reality, you know, of what it means to be us. So yeah. Anyway, I definitely, if it's free on Amazon Prime, I say go for it. Check it out.
All right, y'all. We'll be right back with some freakouts. You know, some days I am so stressed out and overwhelmed and like feel like a burden on everyone in my life and I just need somewhere to go. And that's why I'm really grateful that the Games Hotline exists. We started the Games and Online Harassment Hotline to support people who make and play games with all of the emotional support that they need. We specialize in issues around online harassment and gaming in general, but we're here for really anytime you're feeling heightened or stressed or just need someone to talk to. You know, we're confidential, we are anonymous. You only have to tell us what you want to tell us and nothing more. So if you want to know more, check out gameshotline.org. Or if you want to get started right now, you can text support to 23368 anywhere in the US and you'll be connected with an agent. That's gameshotline.org or text support to 23368.
What's your freakout?
Now it's time to talk about what's been thrilling us, moving us, upsetting us, or infuriating us this past week. Carolyn, what are you freaking out about?
I'm freaking out about, my friend, the critic, the film critic, Walter Cha, who was on this very podcast to talk about Minari with us once upon a time. Mm-hmm. He has just done something that I think is really, really cool and that I really encourage people to check out if they can. So on Netflix, there's a new series of video essays called Voir, V-O-I-R. It's, I guess it's like produced or executive produced by David Fincher. You know, it has his name prominently featured on it. But anyway, it's a series of just individual video essays about film. And I think each one's like roughly 20 minutes long or so. And so, and you could just skip to, you know, I haven't watched all of them. So, you know, you just skip to the ones that you're interested in, or you watch all of them. But Walter...
Are those the options, Carolyn?
Yes, that's how it works. But Walter contributed an essay, and I'm so thrilled that he got the opportunity to do this, and it's so good. His essay is on the film 48 Hours, the sort of buddy... Not buddy, because there's a lot of tension between them. That's the wrong word. But the race comedy action drama, 48 Hours, starring Nick Nolte and Eddie Murphy. In fact, it was Eddie Murphy's first screen performance. And really, you know, I mean, he'd of course done Saturday Night Live and stuff before, but it really, I think, put him on the map as like a screen star. And Walter's read on the film is such a fascinating and, you know, complicating perspective, right? I mean, what Walter does, I think a lot of people just sort of maybe dismiss that film as a, you know, as like a whatever. It's an action comedy. Maybe you find it entertaining. Maybe you just find it kind of problematic in some of its, you know, some of the ways it engages with race, you know, whatever. But he really, I think whatever your thoughts on that film, or even if you haven't seen, I think you can watch the essay not having seen the film. But, you know, if you have a pre-existing notion of that film, I can almost guarantee that Walter will kind of complicate what you think that film is, or what you think of the dynamic between the two leads in that film. And, you know, it's just outstanding criticism, and it's, anyway, I've, you know, grown to really admire Walter's work over the past few years as I've read him more and more. Now I've had the chance to meet him a few times, and just think he's one of our most essential and vital film critics, you know, of this era. And so, yeah, I encourage people to check that out on Netflix. It's the final episode in the series. But again, because of how Netflix and episodes work, you can skip right to it and just watch that one if you want.
Nice. That sounds awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Ebony, what you got?
I am freaking out about a book called Circe by Madeline Miller, a book that Anita is currently reading right now.
Yeah.
So
which was recommended to me by Jay, our programs manager at Feminist Frequency.
Shout out Jay.
Yeah. You should reach out to Jay and we should have a book club about it.
Yeah, we really should, because I cannot tell you how much I loved this book. I was just overwhelmed by how masterfully it is written, how immersive it is. So Circe is the story of from Greek mythology, who is the daughter of one of the Titans. And, you know, through... just the labyrinthine politics, you know, of the court, essentially, of Greek gods and goddesses and, you know, the assorted powers, winds up exiled to this isolated island and, you know, spends generations, hundreds, thousands of years, you know, sort of coming to terms with who she is, what her powers are, her difference, her desire, what makes her different from humans, but also makes her different from, you know, the gods among whom she grew up. I'm not giving even 100th of a sense of how compelling this story is. I think I finished it in like a day because I just could not stop reading. It is propulsive. It is thrilling. It is horrifying. It is beautiful, and I am seeing, like, I have the author's webpage up right now, and it looks like they're going to be adapting it into a series on HBO Max, which I am both excited for and also really nervous for, because it is a book that does not offer easy answers. There are horrible things that happen that are not undone. There's just such like heart-wrenching pain, and there's love and loss and, you know, finally understanding. And I loved this book so much that, in fact, like, you know, sometimes, Anita, you read something and it's so good you don't want to pick up anything else for a little bit because you know it won't be as good. you know, and you're like, this is gonna make me feel bad about everything I read after this. So I'm gonna have to give it like a day or two before I pick up anything else. That's how much I loved this book. So nice. Cersei by Madeline Miller. Loved it.
I'm not having the same reaction you're having to it.
But of course not. You and I never agree.
That's not true at all. I've recommended some books that you really liked, Ebony.
That is true. That is true.
But it doesn't mean I'm not, because it's interesting because you actually, I thought I was like halfway through the book, but your description stopped where I am at currently. So I'm really curious what the like last half of the book and where that's going to go. And because I Jay gives me really great book recommendations. So maybe I will come back with a freak out about my take on it.
Yeah.
We'll see how that goes. I am freaking out because we're recording this on Sunday, December 12th. And I just got back from the Walt Disney Concert Hall here in downtown LA, which is a beautiful, beautiful music hall that's like acoustically sound and all that kind of nonsense. And I just watched a screening of Home Alone with a live orchestra and choir performance.
What? I'm sorry. What? Home Alone?
Yes. So I did not know this, but Home Alone, which I only saw once as a child, like I do not have the warm fuzzies that a lot of people have about it. Christmas movies. It is a John Williams score, and the score is phenomenal. And I was just like, this is some dumb kids movie from my childhood, but like, it's gorgeous. And hearing it live in and like the LA Philharmonic, and then like after the intermission there was a choir singing all of the choir part, it was just absolutely stunning. And I know that lots of different towns do this where they'll like play live scores to movies that they're screening, and it's a really I don't know, it's kind of an emotional, kind of interesting experience, so I highly recommend it. Also, if you rewatch that movie, like listen to the score. Also, listen to the score because it's Harry Potter. Like Harry Potter totally just ripped off the Home Alone score.
John Williams ripped off his own score.
Yes. Right. Yes. Exactly. Yes.
You know when you would just like change the title of a paper that you turned in and then turn it in for another class.
He's just like, this was so good. Why would I change it? I'm just gonna keep using this over and over again. Mm-hmm. So yeah. Anyways, who knew? Who knew Home Alone? And also like. It's still kind of, it's kind of a cute movie, you know? It's fine. It holds up.
I mean, I do like when Joe Pesci opens the door and gets his head burned. That's fun, you know, that's funny moment there, yes.
I was also thinking about, what's the name of the other actor that's the other?
Daniel Stern?
Yeah. He's so good.
Oh, he's great.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, like, Daniel Stern's great.
I know. And I think we've talked about him and I was like, I don't know who you're talking about, but he's just like, his comedic timing is so good in this movie that I was like, good job, buddy. If you want to submit your own freakout, you can do that at feministfrequency.com/freakout. That's FREQOUT. Thank you so much for listening to Feminist Frequency Radio. Carolyn, we're so happy to have you back. Do you want to shout out anything you're working on, your social media, people find you if they're new to the podcast?
Sure. I mean, just the best place to, you know, find me is to follow me probably on Twitter at Carolyn Michelle, CAROLYN Michelle. I feel like I need to spell Carolyn out because every time I go to a coffee shop and I say my name is Carolyn, they always write Caroline, and my name is not Caroline.
I know, and we actually have listeners who write in and call you Carol, and we're like, right. No, it's Caro, C-A-R-O.
Caro for short, you know, Carolyn or Caro, not Carol, and not Caroline. So please follow me on Twitter, and, you know, I share all random thoughts about movies, about video games, links to articles that we publish on Kotaku that I think are valuable and interesting, or just goofy and fun. That's probably the best thing to do if you want more Caro in your life.
Always want more Caro in my life.
Yeah.
This is the last episode of the season and of the year, so thank you for joining us for this whole year. I feel like we have just totally dropped the ball on video games. So in the new year, I'm going to start. We're thinking about bringing back some gaming content.
Yes,
onto the podcast.
Do it.
We might have you back on, Carolyn, to do some of that with us occasionally.
It. Yeah.
But so yeah, if you are all missing some gaming stuff, we're gonna do some of that. And yeah, so you know, stay tuned. The Star Trek Discovery Season 4 podcast is running and will be running through the rest of the year into the new year. So if you miss me, that's where I will be. but other than that, we'll see you in the new year.
Right on.
Our show is engineered by Rob Parra. Carrie Stimson provides technical support. Artwork by Jamie Varon. And our intro music is by Phil Circus. Thanks for listening.
Bye.
Bye, folks.
Bye.